With the election right around the corner and our ever-expanding network of podcasts, including our most recent edition, Scylla Consciousness, there's never been a better time to become a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, and enhanced show notes for select shows. Our goal is to make the DSR Network membership accessible to everyone, so for the month of May, enjoy 60% off the normal monthly or annual price for the first month or first year. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code MAYDAY, one word, at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code MAYDAY. Thank you very much for your support.
Welcome to Scylla Consciousness, the DSR Network podcast focusing on the artificial intelligence revolution, politics, and policy.
Hello and welcome to Scylla Consciousness. I'm David Rothkopf. I'm your host, and it is my pleasure to say that we are joined today by Rob Atkinson. Rob is the founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, which is the leading science and tech think tank here in Washington, D.C. He is an internationally recognized scholar and an author of many articles and books, including Technology Fears and Scapegoats, which, if I am correct, Rob, comes out today. Is that not true?
Is it May 7th today?
It's May 7th.
And you are right.
Well, congratulations. Here we are to celebrate the publication of the book. What is it that led you guys to write it?
So I've had a longtime colleague for, over 30 years now, David Moshella. And David comes out of the IT industry. He was an editor at Computer World magazine and had written many books on the IT sector. And as David and I colluded on a lot of things over the years, it became clear to us in the last few years that the whole overall image and feeling towards not just technology companies, but technology in general, had really degraded. And much of that narrative now in the U.S. was very much oriented to negative views, most of them based upon what we argued were myths. Just simply things that weren't true or were dramatically over-exaggerated. And the problem is, once these myths take hold, people are like, oh, of course, we all know that it's social media that caused President Trump to be elected. Or, oh, we all know that AI is going to kill all the jobs. Or we all know that facial recognition is racially biased. And it turns out none of these are really true, or at least they're over-exaggerated. So we decided to write this book. We came up with 40 myths. We go through them, why they're a myth, what the myth is, why they're a myth. And then we conclude with, you know, what do we need to do as a society to get back to a more balanced view of technology and technology companies?
What are the principal drivers of the myths? I mean, is there a single source, or is this a society-wide phenomenon?
Well, we lay out in the first chapter what we think are six or eight of the major drivers. They're really all over the place. One is, if you write a book today that says, hey, AI is pretty good, there's a few challenges, but it's mostly good, it's a lot easier to write the opposite book that, you know, AI is going to destroy the human race, as Elon Musk says. So just to be able to publish books and get on a really good TED talk, it's better to be negative. You're just going to get more attention that way. Secondly, you've had, I think, the elite class has, rather than acknowledge when President Trump won that perhaps there were some problems that they had caused, like the financial collapse, like forever wars, other things like that, rather than say, wait a minute, what's really going on here? Kind of what John Judas argued elite classes should always do when there's a populist explosion. You should look inward and say, how did we contribute to that? they just said, no, it can't be. It has to be that the rubes were influenced and got off track by social media. So we're going to blame all of this on social media. Another one is what I would call the rise of anti-capitalists or the far left. You know, David, you and I are both involved in democratic politics. Well, I shouldn't say politics. I'm involved in democratic policy. I was, and I think you were too, kind of a Bill Clintonite, New Democrat. And the Democratic Party has moved very far to the left. And some of those voices are essentially anti-capitalist, anti-corporate. They just do not like what we have. And so if you're going to convince people that the system we have is pretty bad and we've got to have a radical replacement, like no more broadband providers, the government needs to own broadband, no more drug companies, the government needs to build and develop and make drugs, on and on and on, you've got to come up with a pretty negative narrative that people believe. My favorite one in the book is this notion that productivity has had no benefits to American workers. So if you believe that, which is simply factually not true, there has been a growth of income inequality, which is a problem, but productivity has still benefited American workers. But if you want to argue that the current system should be radically overhauled, you say things like productivity hasn't benefited workers because what have we lose by overhauling it? So a lot of different factors that have come about. There's no one factor. Another one, frankly, is the tech industry has not done a very good job of defending themselves. There have been some, if you want to use the term, own goals that have happened. But it's a lot of different things, and it's going to take a lot of different solutions to get back to a more neutral or hopefully positive narrative.
Yeah, or a more balanced narrative. I mean, it's
more balanced narrative. Exactly.
Right. I mean, some regulation makes some sense. Some companies overreach. Some companies are monopolistic. Although, you and I talked the other day, and one of the things you talked about was one of the myths was, that big is bad in all cases, but that in some cases you need scale in order to achieve cost savings and also innovation. Maybe you'd talk about that a little.
Yeah. So again, if you listen to the Lena Khans of the world or the Elizabeth Warrens of the world, the narrative is that, large corporations are not serving the American public the way they should. But what's really striking is you don't hear that complaint generally from the AFL-CIO. And the reason you don't hear it is because large corporations, on average, again, this is all average. You've got some terrible large corporations, some terrible scofflaw small companies. But on average, large corporations, they pay their workers more, they have better benefits, they injure their workers less, and they're more unionized. And you can go on and on and down the list of just things. They have a more diverse workforce, all this stuff. So unfortunately, we've moved into this narrative that big is bad, small is good. And again, to your point, David, this isn't about no regulation or anything like that. We're the farthest thing from libertarians you can imagine. But it is about finding the right balance there. If we start demonizing large companies, we're going to demonize half of the workers in the U.S. because they work for large companies. So we got to, again, come back to that narrative we had 20 years ago.
Yeah, I'm all for balancing that stuff out. I think I started out as a Clinton, new Democrat, third way kind of guy. And I've moved a little bit left over time because I think some of what we did was a little bit too market oriented, and that promoted things like inequality. But the market has some values. It creates a lot of the benefits that we've got in society. And so we have to strike the balance. One of the places where we're just starting to struggle with that issue is the focus of this podcast, which is artificial intelligence. And one of the challenges that we face in that regard is that the misconceptions about artificial intelligence begin almost the moment you speak the acronym. Because, people who say AI is, unless the end of the sentence is vast and complicated, tend to be oversimplifying. What are some of the myths and misconceptions that you talk about pertaining to AI in your book?
Well, David, you're absolutely right. The term intelligence is really a misnomer. You know, you take a kid in high school that has a Hewlett-Packard calculator. I mean, it can do amazing things. You put these numbers in there, comes out with this equation or this solution. Like, well, how did it do that, man? That calculator must be intelligent. Not intelligent. It's just software. We're just nowhere near intelligence. We think it's intelligence because we talk to our Siri or our Hey Google, and they say something back, but there's no intelligence there. So to be fair, of course, AI is important, super innovative, but it's not intelligence. And once you start going over that intelligence line, you start with all sorts of problems. Number one, Elon Musk, I give Elon credit because at one point he was saying that AI was going to exterminate the human race. But more recently he said it's not going to exterminate the human race. Don't be ridiculous. It's basically just going to put us up into the mountains, kind of how gorillas have been moved up into the mountains in these preserves in Africa. We'll just have our own little space up in the mountains and AI will take over. They have no need to kill us. They just want to. Okay, that's such a relief. So that's number one, just AI and this existential threat, I think, number one. Number two is eliminating most or all of the jobs. Yes, if we're lucky, AI will boost productivity and hopefully 1 or 2 percentage points, maybe 3. But there are just so many jobs that AI can't do. I'll give you an example. My plumbing the other day, you know, we live in an old house in Bethesda, and it clogged up on the street, near the street. No way an AI can diagnose or fix that. And my great plumber came over and he fixed it. There's way more jobs than that than there are jobs that can't be done or that can be done by AI. Again, not to say that AI won't have very important implications, but it's not going to eliminate all jobs. So rather than a narrative about that, we should have a narrative about why is the U.S. so bad at a system to help workers make transitions. We're terrible at that, and it's a policy choice policymakers make. You go to countries like Singapore or some in Europe that are like the Scandinavians. They do a world-class job of helping workers make transitions when they've lost their job, and we don't. So let's argue about that. Not about is AI going to kill all the jobs.
Sometimes our impediments to doing the right things in those cases are ideological and they have to do with labels and politics. One of the examples that I always give is that during the 2007-2008 financial crisis, two automobile companies faced a crisis. In the United States, because the collapse of the company here would have caused the dislocation of 1 million jobs and there was no safety net, we had to bail the company out. In Scandinavia, the company was Saab. And what the Swedes did was they said, well, we have a system for retraining people. We have safety nets in our society. And so we're going to let the market take its course and Saab's going to disappear, but we'll retrain those people. So, you know, you could say, well, that's a socialist system and we're a capitalist system, but the capitalist system wasn't solving the problem. The socialist system was adapting to the market reality better than the capitalist system was. So, you know, you sometimes need government programs to help retrain people, to educate people, and to deal with big disruptions. And as you say, with regard to AI, you know, the estimates are, and again, these are all suspect, but the estimates are that perhaps AI may result in 20 to 30% of jobs being changed dramatically or eliminated in over a period of time in developed economies. The question is, what comes next and how do you prepare for it? Not, oh my God, stop AI, right? I mean, I think that's the point.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, but even that, when you think about it, that's not a very high rate of churn. You know, one of the things that's interesting is if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they, since 1995, they've come out with data every quarter, and they say what share of jobs were lost because a company downsized or a company went out of business. And the answer is in 2022, which is the latest year I looked at, it's the lowest it's ever been since 1995. So counter to what most people think. The labor market has become more secure. But that doesn't let policymakers off the hook of doing exactly what you said that Sweden needs to do, that Sweden did. We don't do it. So we could be doing those things with regard to AI. I actually think the biggest challenge the U.S. is going to face is not that. It's going to be, how do we raise productivity? Because you and I and a bunch of people who are baby boomers, we're going to be sucking up large quantities of money because we're not working. We're taking Social Security. We're going to be buying and selling off our stocks and our bonds. We're going to be taking a lot of resources. And that means if the GDP doesn't go up, by definition, other people will have fewer resources. I mean, the only answer to that is higher productivity. And that's why we need AI.
So you are right at sort of the cutting edge of part of the problem that we've got, though. And that is, it's not just Elon Musk misrepresenting, and it's not just that this is a big, complicated issue that can't really be encapsulated in one thing. AI is really about a kind of technology that changes every industry in fairly substantial ways. It's not one thing. But in Washington, where you live, where we live, a lot of the people who are responsible for developing policies to deal with this are really unfamiliar with the nuts and bolts of it. They don't even understand the full vocabulary. Assess that challenge and how we deal with it. This podcast is underwritten in part by the U.S. Embassy of the United Arab Emirates. Its editorial content is completely independent, and the views expressed are exclusively those of participating experts. It is presented live without editing. For further information about the UAE's efforts in the areas of artificial intelligence and technology, go to the website of the embassy at www.uae-embassy.org and search for UAE-US Tech Cooperation. We thank them for their support. We thank everybody who's supporting this podcast for their support, and we look forward to it developing and growing over time because the issue is so important.
So, look, when you're a legislator, there are committees, so there's some specialization, but even if you're on a committee, you're dealing with 50 different things. So I'm never one to criticize members of Congress, and I know you're not either, David, but I get frustrated. Well, why doesn't this member of Congress know about how the difference between ChatGPT-3 and ChatGPT-4? Look, they're dealing with a million things, and that's not their job. It's to some extent their staff's job to figure that out. And I do see that congressional staff are learning more about AI. I see Biden administration people learning more about AI. But I still think the biggest mistake we're making is we think of AI as one thing, as you just pointed out. It'd be like saying, you know what we need in 1985, we need a PC policy because personal computers are going to be everywhere. No, they're going to be used in different ways in different applications. And so we need to be thinking about, as ITIF will be doing, we're releasing a report quite soon looking at 34 different discrete policy concerns that that policymakers have about AI. And there's 34 of them at least. And one of them is bias. One of them is deepfakes. One of them is privacy. And so what we need to do is we need to step it down and take a more nuanced look at, you know, what are we really talking about? And how does this particular area of application of AI or concern, how does it manifest itself? And, you know, what do we ought to do about it, if anything?
And I think, having said that, it probably would be better if the next generation of policymakers we get in Washington were a little bit better trained in a lot of the technology and science issues you deal with. We've dealt with the backlash against science in the course of the past few years, which, of course, has been hugely destructive. And many of these technologies are transformative and will be transformative over the course of the entire careers of the rising generation. They're going to have to adapt constantly. They're going to have to re-educate themselves constantly. How well equipped do you think we are for training policymakers to meet this challenge?
Well, I don't think we're very well equipped at all. I spoke at one of these, you know, high-level roundtables about a year ago, and there's 70 people from different countries on sort of what do we do about national security and U.S. competitiveness and technology. And I was struck by a leading light. You and I both know this person, who said, you know, one of the problems we have is everybody in my generation, when we learned this stuff, we didn't learn technology. We learned all these other things, but we didn't learn technology. And by that, I don't mean we didn't learn how to do, Ruby coding or something in computer science, but just didn't get exposed to it. I think that's a huge problem. Now, one of the benefits, I think, is that younger people are getting exposed to that more regularly. But we really don't have a very good system for people at state, for example, or people at commerce, or even Hill staff. One of the things that we do is we do what we call a Tech 202 class every year. We bring Hill staffers, a small group of Hill staffers, once a week for 6 weeks. And this year was all on AI, so it was on AI and biotechnology and biological innovation. It was AI and cyber. I do think that we need to do a lot more of that sort of thing, of just specifically educating policymakers into a deeper dive on AI. Again, you don't need to be a coder. My son's getting his PhD in computer science and AI. I have no idea what he does, something about matrices and this and that. I don't need to know that. I need to know sort of the general parts of it and something, so policymakers don't need to know that level of depth, but they do need to know the basics, as you were talking about.
Well, you don't need to know it because your son is doing it and he can support you in your old age.
That's why I want him to go to a startup and make a boatload of money. Somehow he hasn't said he wants to do that. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, hopefully he'll come to his senses.
Exactly.
As you go over the list and you talk about some of these AI issues, a lot of them go beyond what any individual nation can do in terms of solving some of the regulatory challenges or addressing some of the risks, whether it's autonomous weapons platforms, AI-assisted cyber, deep fakes, disinformation, or even just trade in highly competitive technologies. There is a big international component to this. And if there are gaps in U.S. training, and the awareness among U.S. policymakers, my experience is that there are even greater gaps internationally, particularly between the developed world and the emerging world. How do you assess that as a challenge?
Yeah, I have to say, I actually think some of the countries in the developed world are more educated, more sophisticated. I think Israel is a good example of that. They're very sophisticated on understanding this. I think Singapore is. I do a lot in Korea, and the officials I talk to in Seoul, they really get this. So I think we need to catch up. But absolutely in the developing world, that's a challenge. Again, I think the way to think about this is we have to think about each of these as discrete challenges. Let's use deepfakes as an example. There is simply no way that you can solve the deepfake problem, because anybody in the world can use AI. You can be in the middle of nowhere up in a village, and as long as you got internet access and a computer, you can use AI and you can manipulate a video of President Biden doing whatever it is. There's no way we can regulate that. Because we could regulate it in the U.S. We could say it's against the law to do that, or it has to be labeled. But you can't stop some rogue actor doing it. What we can do, and even if we were to do a global treaty and everybody agrees to this, there will still be rogue actors. What we can do and are doing is some of the leading companies like Adobe and Microsoft and others, they're coming up with technologies that will allow you to identify if something has been manipulated or has not. And I think we'll end up in a world where if you see something and it isn't labeled like that, the default will be it's probably fake. But we're just going to have to live in a world where there's more deep fakes, and we're not going to stop that, but we can try to take steps to improve it. I think things like weapon systems, I don't think we can stop that either. And the reason is, this is not like nuclear weapons, where it's fairly straightforward. I'm not a nuclear weapons inspection expert, but you know, there's a regime and you can sort of tell how much the Soviets are doing and how much the Chinese are doing, and we could come up with treaties to limit nuclear weapons. How are you going to do that with AI? Because you can't go in and inspect code. So I think ultimately, and again, you're not going to be able to affect rogue actors. Rogue actors could come up with an AI-controlled drones, and they will, and we're just going to have to figure out ways to respond to that. Now, I think safety is a different issue. We can and should come up with a global regime on safety, not so much about regulation, but about deep research and science on how do you design AI systems that ultimately are always going to be controlled. That's something we should collaborate on internationally. We should do that sooner rather than later.
You know, one of the initiatives of the Biden administration, and I'm supportive of a lot of their initiatives, but one of the initiatives has been to restrict the trade to China of a number of technologies that might help China maintain leadership they have in some areas in AI or gain capabilities that they don't already have. And I've talked to leading technologists, and they say these are likely to be ineffective because the trade in these technologies is pretty much global as it is. And the Chinese have some very, very advanced capabilities right now. I also think that this definition of the U.S.-China relationship, which is the most important in the world in terms of who's going to win the AI war, is counterproductive. But perhaps you disagree with me.
Well, I agree in the sense of, I mean, a couple of things. If I do think that ensuring that Chinese technology advancement does not come at the cost of the West's capabilities, we're not going to be able to stop China from advancing. They want to advance, very hard for us to stop it, even with export controls. What we can't allow to happen is they to destroy the West's sort of leading industries. We can't sort of be de-technologized from by the Chinese. But that's very different than saying the Chinese, we can stop them from getting AI. You know, the other problem with this is we approach this from our lens, like you can do AI with less efficient chips. You just have to spend more. You got to pay more. You got to have more chips thrown at the problem. They don't care. They're happy to do that. The cost is not a problem for them. So I agree with you, David. I don't think we're going to be able to stop them. The other thing is, why AI? Why aren't we doing similar things with regard to space, biotechnology, the whole set of technologies? And why have we sort of myopically focused on chips and AI? Now, the answer will be, well, these are foundational technologies, they're super important, they're going to be used for everything. But I can make that same argument about a lot of things. Like the Chinese are dramatically expanding their capabilities in robotics and autonomous systems. We just issued in a report at ITIF looking at the Chinese robotics industry and how sophisticated it is. Why aren't we doing something about that? So I do think, though, that AI is so important that I don't need to degrade China, but I do need to make sure that we're still doing a great job of AI innovation in this country. I do think that's critical for us.
Well, yes. And another thing, and the Biden administration does deserve credit for this, is the recognition that there are certain supply chains on which advanced economies will depend going forward that we're quite vulnerable on, like the creation, fabrication of chips and so forth. And they are taking some steps to offset our vulnerabilities there. Although even with the steps they've taken in investing in new fabs in New York and in the Southwest, that still really is going to only address 10 or 20% of our needs in this area. So we've got a long way to go, right?
Well, we were early on big supporters of the CHIPS Act and the science component of that, worked closely with the Senate on that. You're now seeing the Biden administration putting out big funding streams, getting a lot of announcements, Micron, IBM, I think it was IBM, certainly Intel, Samsung, TSMC. So that's critical. That's critical. The other component of that, which we shouldn't lose sight of, is there's also a 25% investment tax credit now for semiconductor fabs and all the equipment. And that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. So I'm cautiously optimistic that in 5 to 10 years, we'll be in significantly better shape with regard to fabs. Remember, we don't have to have them all. They're going to be fabs in Europe. There'll be fabs in Japan. We don't have to have them all. As long as they're not all in Taiwan and China, then our vulnerabilities go significantly down.
Totally agree with you. I one of the things I embrace about your vision of all this is that it's both fairly optimistic and fairly practical. As we wrap up here, what are the things that worry you about what's coming next with regard to AI?
It's a two-headed coin, obviously. And so one of the things that I worry about, and I'll get to the other in a moment, but I do worry that policymakers will overreact with problematic regulation. Because, David, as you know, I'm farthest thing from a libertarian. We need a national privacy regulation. You know, I get all that. We do need some smart rules with regard to AI. But if you look at the AI Act in Europe, it's very problematic. It goes overboard. The proposed Canadian AI Act, IATA, I think it is, very problematic law. I mean, Canada sort of, geez, if you're going to pick one, just pick Europe. Don't create your own separate one. And now you got Europe for their companies. So I worry that we're going to overreact and move too fast. I mean, one of the interesting things about the European AI Act is it was on paper. It was all written down, ready to be voted on. And then, oops, ChatGPT-3 came out. Like, oh, wait, we better rethink this. So that's not a message to say we should stop. What I do think is really, really encouraging is what we saw, a bipartisan effort in the Senate this year with Senator Schumer, Senator Young, and a number of other leading Democrats and Republicans. And they held, I don't know how many, 12 listening sessions on everything from jobs, which is my testified ad, to, you know, AI threats. That's the kind of steps we need to take. You're old enough to remember when Congress actually used to do regular order and they deliberated, they would have hearings. So we can't rush into this. Congress will get this right if we just do it the way we've always done it, which is deliberate, careful, cautious, let's move forward. So I do think that's one of the things I worry about. And the reason I worry about that is I think AI is so important that we have to complement sort of the regulatory side with the promotion side. Like, you look at what China's doing with regard to AI and logistics, or AI and manufacturing, smart manufacturing. It's really important. Or what they're doing with AI and drug development. So we need to, there are a bunch of areas in government, like for example, education, like logistics, like health, where AI could make a really important contribution. But that contribution will be less if government doesn't play a convening role, a combining role, putting data together. I mean, imagine if we had a really globally innovative AI system on health and diagnostics. The healthcare system would just look very different than it looks today. And we don't have that. And we'll get there eventually. These things are inexorable. But I want to get there in 5 years, not 15 or 20 years. So I do worry about us not doing enough because of either libertarian tendencies in the U.S. You know, there's still this free market ideology that's pretty dominant that says, oh, you know, the private sector will get all this right. Yeah, eventually. But we don't really have eventually. So that's what I would worry about. And then really the other thing I worry about is really the lack of preparation to help individuals, not just in jobs, losing their jobs, but in being prepared for this new AI economy. You know, David, it's striking that 92% of high school kids today, they take geometry. Guess what percent take statistics? 8. So we need to have a workforce that, as my co-author David Moshella calls, of double deeps. You know something really good about art, but you also know how to do digital. You know about accounting, but you also know how to apply AI to accounting. And stats is one component of that. And we don't even bother teaching it in high school now. So we need to make sure that every kid that's graduating college has some of those capabilities. Then we're not really doing that now. And that, I think, would serve them well. As you noted, people have to reinvent themselves. Well, if you don't even know the kind of the basics of this and you haven't learned that, it's a lot harder to learn it later in life when you've got a job and kids and the like.
Absolutely right. Although I do think lifelong education is also going to be part of this new world. And fortunately for all of us, it's going to be assisted constantly by new AI technologies that will be quite helpful in that regard. I've found this conversation fascinating, and I hope you will come back soon. Rob's book is called Technology Fears and Scapegoats, 40 Myths About Privacy, Jobs, AI, and Today's Innovation Economy. He's done it with David Moshela. It comes out today. Rob has done an enormous service here in Washington by establishing and building the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, ITIF. This is a town that's kind of a science and tech wasteland, or if there are voices out there, they are lobbying for something. They are not analyzing and examining things in the way that a think tank ought to be. And this is the one think tank in Washington that really addresses it. Rob's built it. I have endless admiration for you for having done that. And I'm deeply grateful for you for having joined us. And hopefully you haven't found it too painful and you'll join us again sometime in the future.
David, it's so kind of you to say that. I really, really greatly appreciate that. And thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Go out and get Rob's book and come back next week for more Silliconsciousness. I'm David Rothkopf. Thank you and bye-bye.
This was Silliconsciousness, a production of the DSR Network. Our producer is Riley Fessler, and our executive producer is Chris Cotnoir. For more information on the DSR Network and how to become a member, go to DSRnetwork.com.